Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Cristóbal Tapia de Vere is a maverick whose consistently unique approach to scoring has finally and deservedly thrust him into the spotlight. His family fled the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile shortly after his birth, and while they returned for a time, they eventually made a new home in Quebec, where Cristóbal still lives and works. While the folk music of Chile is always in the background, he was more into Michael Jackson and more extreme forms of metal, but the rhythms and instruments of his birthplace still find a way into his music, contributing to the rich tapestry of his sound. Before getting into scoring, he completed a Master's of Music as a percussionist and even had a small dance music hit with a group called One Ton. In 2006, he self-produced a bedroom-recorded album called The Spider in Charlie's Box, which was intended to introduce him to producers as, quote, a true individual unwilling to follow the rules. This caught the attention of showrunner Mark Munden, who hired Cristóbal to score the period drama The Crimson Petal and The White. This led to Utopia, which was a breakout for De Vere, who was noted for his novel scoring. More shows would follow, including Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, Humans, and Black Mirror. It feels as if he's been consistently working on a musical thesis, which has culminated in his much-lauded score for The White Lotus. We chat about his early days, his instinctive approach to music making, his punk attitude and the feeling that music should be noticed like another character on the screen, and the strange time he spent working with Kanye West that ultimately provided the materials for his groundbreaking score for The White Lotus. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy this conversation with the one and only Cristóbal Tapia de Vere. Cristóbal, welcome to the Screen Composer Studio.
Thank you.
Very excited to talk to you. As I mentioned before, we started recording. I'm a big fan. I've been following your work for a long time. And I wanted to offer a huge congratulations. You were just recently awarded a Best Music for TV from the Society of Composers and Lyricists and our sister organization down south.
Yeah, that was really surprising. And it's an honor that, I mean, it's inspiring that other composers can connect with what I'm doing, particularly as it might not be like standard, composition types. I don't know. I tend to think that my stuff is kind of weird. So I'm happy that composers appreciate what I'm doing for the image.
I think it's actually exactly because of that. Your approach is fresh and novel, and your attitude about how you go about doing things, at least from what I've read in interviews and heard in the podcasts that you've already done, you have a very different way of thinking about a lot of this stuff. And I think that's what people are responding to, which is great. Obviously, White Lotus has done incredibly well, both as a work and in terms of how your music has been received within it, which is wonderful. And we're going to get to that. My personal fascination with all of this, being a fan and sort of seeing the progression, is noting that this is like, in some ways, you know, the rest of the world is catching on and seeing you arrive to something. And this work that you're doing and the way you're approaching it, I think you've been building this sort of approach. And I feel like you're working on a thesis, a musical thesis over all these different series and films that you've been working on. So it's really interesting to see you get here. You have an interesting start to life, a bit of a violent and chaotic start as you were born in Chile. And then your parents had to move almost immediately. Can you talk a bit about those early years?
Yeah, that's correct. I suppose since I was in my, you know, my mom was pregnant with me when there was the coup in Chile, the military takeover. So she was running around with me inside with the belly bouncing, escaping from police and, bombs and this and that. Maybe that gave me some sense of rhythm. So I was like really born into that moment. After that, well, I don't know. My parents, we left for Paris for a little bit, maybe a couple of years. And then we came back to Chile and that's it. I grew up in Chile until I was 15.
Wow.
And then we moved to Canada.
And during those years, I mean, that's under Pinochet. So there's definitely a certain kind of environment that is probably very unusual or not common to a lot of other people who are, you know, born in Canada. Do you feel like that's, I mean, it must have affected you. How did it affect you in terms of your approach to art and in terms of your relationship to Chile and maybe even the music of Chile? Because I feel like I hear some of that that realm still in your music now. I wonder if that's a big formative aspect of your growing up.
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to answer because I don't have any. I don't know how to compare it to, you know, another like a normal growing up situation. But I suppose. As far as music, I mean, in Chile, when you're from the capital, I'm from Santiago, and it's a big city, and it was like, you know, it's like a 7 or 8 million people, and it's very chaotic. And then I don't remember ever being into like folk, like local, like South American folklore. We were very much into, you know, American music or English music and whatnot. So, you know, pop, I was a big fan of, like Michael Jackson was the big thing for me at some point when I was like, I don't know, maybe 12, something like that. It's probably the first talk I did in front of a classroom. The first presentation I have to make in a school was about Michael Jackson. And then and stuff like that, you know, and then break dance, you know, and learning how to dance that stuff. And then at some point metal, I got into all the most extreme type of, you know, black metal, death metal, and all of that stuff. And that was all about finding the most extreme new band that plays faster and angry. So, but the music is in the background, always the folk, because in South America, there's a nylon string guitar in every house. And whenever there's family that comes, whoever grabs a guitar and everybody can play some songs and they start singing stuff. And also you see bands in the street playing, you know, the big flutes, all this traditional stuff from Latin America. So it's always there, but I wasn't like, you know, into that much. That wasn't like a cool thing to do. I suppose now, if I'm going back to that and bringing influences from that and everything, is because that I think that is so strong that even if I wasn't like actively listening to folk music, you're part of that. So it just gets into your DNA or something. And now I appreciate more, and I really have a feeling and a certain joy to play those rhythms and everything. And I maybe it's because I found ways that folk music can be my music. And maybe at that time, maybe listening to, I don't know, pop music or rock music was somehow an escape or something. I don't know. I haven't put that much thinking into that. But yeah, it feels like now I could appropriate myself, appropriate that music for me. So, and it's very moving. When I listen to anything from Latin America, it's instant emotion or you know, I start crying because I remember, you know, somewhere in the mountains or somewhere near the ocean and the houses and the cats and everything. So the music is instead of something that I would have chosen, like pop music, like now if I go on YouTube and I choose something to listen to, it feels like Latin American music somehow chose me because I was there, And I realize it now, because when I listen to that stuff, it feels like it feels like family, like it feels growing up and everything. So it's on another level than just notes and, you know, instruments and this and that. But it took me a really long time to realize that, I suppose. And maybe leaving Chile somehow make that more important. I don't know, because I know people from Chile, from Santiago, that they almost feel like they really live in an American way. Chile is it's one of the more, you know, stable and advanced countries right now in South America. It feels like, in a way, people could feel less Latin America, particularly in the capital, because it's more international or something, and people are looking to, you know, the US or that kind of life and stuff. So in a way, maybe being outside made me closer to that Latin American feeling, that it's a unique thing. It's different, and there's a certain calm in the music. Feels more connected to nature. So I suppose the White Lotus somehow brought that out, and not only that. I suppose in almost any score that I've done, there is some of that, at least in the rhythms. Percussions and everything, it's just a sense of liveliness I'm not sure how to describe it, really.
Yeah, I definitely that's where I would place it in terms of what I think. I mean, there are some times when it feels like there's other aspects of Latin American music in there, but yeah, it's definitely in the rhythms, absolutely. Before we sort of move on in terms of the chronology, I don't know if this is going to be a reach or if I'm jumping around, but to me, one of the things I really appreciate you is how much you're committed to the exploration of your particular ideas about what you like in music and how you think music should work in film. One of the things you said was that you value creative freedom above almost everything else. And you're really committed to that in terms of what you say yes to and no to. I mean, I believe it was you said no to the second season of Humans because, even though it was an immensely popular show, like it had the 7 million viewership or something like that, and was doing really well, you didn't want to come back to it and then repeat yourself. And there's a bit of a punk attitude in terms of some of the things you're doing and how you answer interview questions sometimes, which I really like. And then I just wonder, like, where does that attitude come from? Because that, I think, is almost the most unusual thing. Most people working within, you know, Hollywood or television in general, they're chasing something where they want to be able to say, I fit this certain category, hire me to do these things, as opposed to, no, I'm an individual. This is what you're going to call me for this specific thing. And if I don't work, that's fine, because this is important to me.
Yeah. That is such a long conversation, I think. First, you have to be lucky to be put in a position where you can do what I'm doing, I suppose. And to me, it happens because the first show that I did, Utopia is not the first show, but it's somehow the first show, because I did one show before. It's called the Crimson Petal of the White. It was a year before. And the same director than Utopia. But something happened in Utopia where I did something personal and it worked out. And then people were calling me to do that. So long story short, that put me in a position where I wasn't going for that path or giving people what they want, giving that, let's do this, that cinematic sound, for example. and you know, start doing this all these strings and this and that, and trying to be like a lesser John Williams, or a cheaper, I don't know who, a Goldsmith or whatever. And sometimes it feels like that, like there's a billion composers trying to be, let's say, John Williams. And to me, it feels like there's one guy who does one thing and he should be the only one to do that. But I understand that there is a language of cinematic sound and whatnot. But anyhow, for me, I never chased that. And it's because of that. It's because people started calling me to do something different. And that's what I call, when people ask me about that, I call that like winning the lottery in a way, because it's an incredible privilege, I think. To be able to do like my albums. Like if I wanted to do my album, it would sound like one of the soundtracks I'm doing. It feels like completely personal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get to work with all these amazing people and these actors, which are, instead of having a singer in my band, then I have these actors. So I'm working for the characters. In a band,
right.
In a band, what I remember for me is that your singer is your lead character, and you have to make the music work for that singer that you have. And this feels pretty much the same. So it is a privilege. I don't know really that many people that are able to do that. I know that people from bands, they do scores, like several composers that you know, some directors are fans of Trent Reznor or whoever, and then they start making movies, but they don't necessarily work full time. They still do their projects and stuff, and sometimes they make a movie. But for me, I'm really 100% all the time. This is what I do. I decided with Utopia that I didn't want to do anything else.
How did you meet Mark? Because I know that you've said that Mark was instrumental in sort of, as you said, with Utopia, which got recognized. And this is, by the way, for anyone listening who's wondering, this is the UK version that came out sort of 2013, 2014, not the US version on Amazon. Did he find you because of The Spider in Charlie's Box? Is that how Mark came to your attention, or how you came to his attention?
Yeah, that's what I heard. That's what he heard from me, because I didn't have any soundtracks or anything. And he just, thought that maybe it could work. And we met, and he went on a leap of faith, because he didn't want to have, that standard cinematic sound. He wanted just anything different. And I just tried it. That's it. It was really a guess. And I'm doing this now by accident, really.
Was Mark, it sounds like you were just really great collaborative partners, and that he must have provided a situation for you to be able to stretch and explore, and there must have been a kind of communication that really just worked for both of you.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. I suppose he was always pushing me to find things, ideas, and he would probably pick or go for the more eccentric stuff that I would give him.
Mm.
So that gave me a hint of what I needed to do. And that happened to be what I preferred to do. And it started feeling like the crazier I got, the more, the better feedback I was going to get. So it's kind of addictive, because it's like you're on a path to break rules. And I suppose that's where the rock and roll or the punk attitude, suppose, comes from. And what you said previously, about this punk thing, is that in a way, I think that, I don't know that you can, have a corporative persona and the way you dress and the way you talk and everything, and then and make music and transform into something else and be all crazy and this and that and you know, find ideas that are absolutely outrageous and blah, blah, blah. And to me, that only happens if you are that. I mean, I couldn't, you know, I'd never been good at presentations or interviews or whatever, where it feels like I need to be eloquent and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And I watch, you know, sometimes composers and they're really good at that. But I wasn't like trained to do that. You know, I grew up with bands and it's chaos. It's complete chaos. And it's all, you know, people in bands are always fighting and it's all ego. And it's, and then we would play drunk. And so it's a way of life that is, it's too different, from this seriousness, you know, of the film composer. Where I always feel like, you know, I'm listening to a teacher explaining, you know, these things and these concepts and stuff. So in the beginning, I suppose I was questioning myself a lot at the time of Utopia because it was everything new and I didn't know how I was supposed to be. But with time, it felt like whenever I tried to fit in this world, the stuff that I do, it doesn't really work. Like it's not, it doesn't do anything. And I realized I really have to exploit what I'm supposed to do. And that's the thing that works for me. I suppose it can be, I'm going to say that there was like a rough period of time where I didn't know how to speak with producers, for example. Executives.
Oh, okay.
And people like that. And that can be really scary for them because composers are very nurturing, I feel, the way they talk to producers and everything. And you need to reassure people that, you know, everything's going to go their way.
Right.
They're going to like it and this and that. And I had to learn how to do that. But for a while, it was pretty tough because there was lots of, you know, frictions and tension. And I would have maybe one or two allies in a production that they understand. I need to do whatever I need to do, like mostly the director and maybe one producer. And then there's a whole gang of people in our production that are like, what is this guy doing? What's happening? But in the end, the only thing that saved me from being, you know, going into the dark, being blacklisted or whatever, but because this happens in this business, anyone, actors, whoever, you know, this guy is just too difficult to work with. That guy is out. But I think what saved me is their reaction to the music. Well, like when projects came out, the reaction was so strong to the music. And the producers felt that. And I think at some point it started going around to a point where it feels like people now lately are less, you know, scared or I don't know how to explain, but maybe it's just like, okay, this guy is like that. It doesn't matter. The music is going to work and the director is happy and it's all good. It's whatever. We don't understand what he's saying, but the music is going to work. So whatever. So I kind of put everything into the music. Like I really put all the eggs in the same place. I'm counting right. Music to keep me afloat and keep me out of trouble. And this and that. And of course, the awards do help a lot in that sense where, like for me, it's really important, the awards, the recognition and everything. But I think one of the most important things is that people have a sense of trust that whatever I do, it somehow works. And there's this proof here. There's these statues and you know, the BAFTA and whatnot. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm managing to make people concentrate on what I'm doing and not, you know, what I'm saying and whatnot. and that stuff, it shouldn't matter. I don't think it should matter. Right. I think people should focus on the important stuff. And I don't want to sell my music also. I know that you can't convince people that what they're about to hear when I press play, you're going to feel this and you're going to feel that and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And when you press play, they kind of feel everything that you said because you make the connections for them. And it's like kids and they're all, they can see the music that you just explained. But I really don't like that because I don't know what my music is worth if I need to explain it. I mean, I would like to just press play and they get it. And that's it.
Right. Would you say about yourself that you are courageous? Do you feel that to do what you do and to present it the way you do and to have the attitude and position that you do, do you think that's an act of courage?
It's probably ignorance. I mean, courage. I don't know. If you're really convinced of something, and you tell them this is like that. And I mean, it's courage in a way. Yeah, you're saying something that you feel, but at the same time, you have no idea that saying this could get you fired. So I mean, maybe I didn't realize the kind of danger I was putting myself in. So I think there's a lot of ignorance in that, or naivety. I don't know. I suppose there's a blend of all those things, and I suppose that goes into the music too. That probably does define also the sound of the music. I think the music tends to be kind of it can be as creepy as it can be childish. I feel in general and funny, and you know sometimes you put the weirdest sounds together, and that's again it's just. It could be ignorance. I mean, I could get like some really complex chord happening, but it was an accident. It's not like because I'm super savvy or anything. Again, you know, there's lots of, what was that movie, Birdman? The Virtue of Ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. There's something about that. I think it's very easy to censor yourself. I know it's easy for me if I get, you know, insecure about something, and then I start thinking, okay, I'm not gonna send this track and this other track doesn't work, but that's just me. And then sometimes, you know, there's music that I wasn't sure about, and I still send it, and I get the best feedback I got from all the music I've sent, and that, you know, that's a hint that I really need to stop censoring. I let them censor, yeah. You know, I just send it and whatever, if it doesn't work. But self-censoring, I feel it's a real danger because sometimes you're really insecure about the really good stuff. For me, you know, like Utopia was really insecure about the music before it came out. And that has happened several times where I start thinking that the music is just ridiculous. Like it doesn't work at all at some point. This always happens when we're almost done. Like it feels like the music is too much or something like that. And then when it's not, you realize you're really controlling way too much things. And you think you know how people are going to react. I suppose when music is really personal, maybe it's normal to feel insecure because you're proposing something. It's like raising your hand and saying something too personal, and it's like, oh no, and this is terrible. What am I doing and stuff? But then you realize people actually appreciate that more because it feels more honest. You know, it's not like this perfect thing I've been working forever, and you know, it's not spontaneous anymore.
This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights of film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. And now, back to our show. I really appreciate your honesty in terms of, you know, you're sort of saying like the insecurity that comes with it. I know in other interviews you sort of said that you were concerned about ruining a show with the music and you didn't know if you'd gone too far. But at the same time, you also, you know, I think you've said something like music, you want your music to occupy more space. You don't, there's sort of a way of scoring films that's typically done, or scoring television shows, which is transparent. The music sits in the background. It creates a kind of tapestry. It suggests emotions that you might want to feel at any given time. But you, I think you're interested, and I don't think I've heard anyone say it quite this way, is that and this is true in this, in a very tangible sense, I think, that the music becomes its own character. It's a character that occupies as much space as any of the actors on the screen. And I love this sort of dissonance that you're kind of talking about, where on the same hand, you have this very strong feeling about the approach you're taking and this idea that it should take up space. That's a very to me, that would be courageous. If I say, no, give me more space. I want to be in this thing. But then also to have, you know, the normal insecurities that come with working the way you do. I think that's very instructive. I'm sure that'll be helpful for a lot of other composers to hear. Because, you know, for me, certainly, the way that you work and the way that you've done things, I feel like I can come into situations with a bit more courage myself and say, you know, let's do something crazy. Let's really push this and see where it goes. So that, I think that's sort of an extension of the value that you're bringing to everything you're doing. When does the, I don't know how to phrase this exactly. To me, there are a multiple through lines, threads, thematic kind of things. It almost feels like you're working on a thesis in your music, project after project. These rhythms, layering of lots of different percussion instruments. And one of the most interesting things that I find comes up in your music again and again is your approach to the human voice, and placing it in a very unconventional, surprising, and oftentimes slightly upsetting or disturbing or unstabilizing kind of way. Do you have a sense of where that came from? Where did that fascination come from, and why do you keep coming back to it?
I suppose there's something really emotional and warm in voices. There's a closeness, an intimacy that I just can't get from anything else. Like, really, there's no other sound that I can find that. If I start working with some voices, and right away it's like a warm bath, and and I'm gonna make any melody work with that. Where with instruments, sometimes it's like I have this instrument, and then I feel like maybe this is not the right instrument. I want to try this other one, and blah blah. But with voices, it's always like unequivocal or something. There's like a deeper connection, and I don't know what led to that. There's some stuff that I remember from maybe Utopia. There was a track that is almost only voices. It's like three or four voices, naked. Like, there's no reverb, no nothing, and it feels like they're almost in your face. And the director really liked that, and it was a very strong scene where we put that. Maybe that's one of the things that felt like I felt attached to that kind of sound, and then I continued probably in every score, I think, that has come back, those kind of eerie voices that are as familiar as they're somehow unsettling, in the sense that sometimes you can tell that there's something odd about the voices. There's maybe these were not like three people singing this stuff. There's something otherworldly about it. So it gives me, I suppose, two things: is that otherworldliness and but the warmth at the same time. To this day, I'm still today working, with those type of voices, and it gives me, if I'm doing a demo and I'm playing on a keyboard with those voices that I recorded before, so These are very dry, like unproduced sounds. I get a feeling if I could get with the composition, how emotional it's going to get. If I take like fake strings, sound bank, and I play the same thing, I could pass on a good thing. Like maybe I'm not going to realize that the melody is as good as it is because of the sound, because I don't really like these fake strings. And I would start working, I would have to work with that sound, with that sample bank to make it sound good. It feels to me. And with the voice, I feel like I can concentrate on a good or a bad melody because the voices, they just sound good and honest to me. I suppose for lots of composers, that can be the piano, where, you know, you find, you know how it's going to sound once it's, you know, the strings and whatnot. For me, that's my piano is those voices.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It also makes me do music that is simpler because of the nature of the voices. And I can't just jump anywhere and doing all these unnatural things that a voice couldn't do, like intervals or whatever. So it forces me to keep things simple and just to find, you know, chords, a chord selection and a melody that it moves me right away.
Mm-hmm. You certainly push the idea of finding unusual voices, whether it's the human voice or otherwise. I mean, it's very funny to think, you know, on a trip to Zimbabwe, you would say to someone, "Well, I came home with some shit," and they would think, "Well, what kind of instruments?" And you would say, "No, literally shit." And this was stuff you used. You used rhino excrement, and I think you didn't use it, but you had giraffe excrement. You used human bones as part of the music in Utopia. What are you hooking onto when you get sort of into a project? Is there a larger conceptual thing that starts in your head about the approach, or is it simply just sort of getting into like bathing yourself in sort of the idea and the feelings about whatever the project is, and then just starting to experiment? Is it a fairly chaotic process, or do you have a sort of practice that you go down certain paths each time?
I suppose it's chaotic. I would go for things that it feels like are going to inspire me. Just ideas. I mean, the bones, for example, it's. I have a lot more information in my head with bones that I have with a pair of sticks, the drumsticks. So right there, if you know, maybe it's a violent project and whatnot. And there would be some very loose links between the story and why I'm picking bones, but ultimately it's a very fast. Those are very fast and random decisions. It's almost like I'm going for a hiking, and I'm going to grab this knife and this stuff and whatever and put it there and just go. And so it's a lot of instinct, I suppose. I don't think there is that much logic of using bones, because they don't sound really any better than anything. I could use whatever, but I like the idea of bones. I suppose I'm not thinking that much about, you know, a particular sound or scales or notes or anything like really musical. But it's more like going to a party and how I feel like dressing or just to get some vibe or whatever. it's more grabbing whatever feels like could be useful and inspiring. And in the end, maybe I'm not going to use any of that. But I don't think I really have a method.
Do you tend to produce a lot of material for each thing that you work on? I know on Dirk Gently, I think you said it was the most amount of music you'd ever been asked to produce, and it was kind of overwhelming. Do you tend to overproduce as for what's needed? And are you working to picture at the same time, or is it you go into the studio and then come back with things and try it, and sort of a back and forth like that.
If I have the time, I start working before I get any images.
Okay.
Like this movie I'm doing now, I started last summer, and then I got, you know, they were shooting in October. So I had like a couple of months of just making music with the story, with the script. And then, so I had like a huge bank of sounds and possible themes and whatnot. And then when I got the images, then I start trying things, and you know, it becomes clear what work or what doesn't, and I continue from there. So for this one, I've made really a lot of music because we had the time, and I started early. For the White Lotus, it was the opposite. I was like last minute, and I had maybe a month before the real work started, as far as you know, the mix of the pilot, for example. So I had maybe like 5 weeks or something, and I just committed to one sound, and it was the sound of the show, and it was all these percussions and tribal stuff and whatnot. And I recorded as much as I could every day, and all in the same direction. And I wasn't looking for stuff. I was just jamming, really. In my head, it was going to work, and I had no choice because there was no time. And if it didn't work, then I don't know what would have happened. But luckily, it did work. So yeah, for that show, there was like no options of style or whatever. There was one style, and doing lots of jams and whatnot, and then see how everything becomes coherent with the characters and everything.
That's a fascinating approach. This idea that you just have to work very quickly and trust absolutely in yourself and in the process, and you know, just believe that it's going to work out. In terms of where, I mean, there's this incredible story, a very funny story, that involves Kanye West of all people. That begins. Where in the timeline does that fit? And what is the story with Kanye?
You know, at some point he came out with a red hat as a Trump supporter. this was three years ago, or four. I can't remember. But so when that happened, I was with him like a month before that.
Wow!
And I didn't know anything about all that stuff, all the Trump stuff and whatnot. So when I went to LA, for me, it was Kanye, you know, not the Trump supporter and all that stuff. So that was then. And I don't know if it's an interesting story. Did you want to know details about that, or how that happened, or?
Well, yeah, just this, because I know, I think that what ended up happening out of that is there was some sort of, there was a grain of an idea there that came out of the whole thing, but I've heard you tell that story, and I just think it's such a funny, like just a strange cosmic moment, that is sort of unrelated, but still so funny.
I mean, I was in a vibe to find things for Kanye, and when I started jamming these voices of the White Lotus, I suppose because it felt like I needed to find something really outrageous or radically new or something, I was trying to find a way of playing voices that I haven't heard ever. And I found this thing with these voices doing this war cry and stuff, and that I could play on a keyboard, and it felt really fresh. But for some reason, I never showed that to him because I was in LA for a week maybe, and this I found this at the end before leaving, because we couldn't find, long story short, it was becoming chaotic with Kanye, and the people, like my manager was talking to one of his managers, and then he fired that manager, so then we didn't know who we're talking to, and then he fired some other manager, and he was firing people, and it was becoming chaotic, and then we couldn't find a way to make a contract that made sense for me, because I mean, Kanye is kind of well known for, I think you have to be protected with people like this. They can just, you know, take your beat and then whatever, either they forget about you, or they don't give you credit, or whatnot, or they take all their royalties and stuff. So I needed a contract. And because of that we couldn't agree on something, I said, okay, I'm going to leave and I'll come back when this is done, when we have a deal. But then, then he came out of the closet as a Trump supporter. And from then, it became like a new world of Kanye, where who knows what's happening over there.
And this was for, if I'm not mistaken, this was for some sort of a shoe thing with Nike, right? Like or something to that effect. And he flew you out here. How did he find out about, you know, what, who you were and what you were doing, and what was his... Like, what did he tell you was sort of his interest?
I received a call. I was in Europe. I was in Prague. And then I received a call from Amy, who was his assistant. And we were like, me and my manager is like, this has to be a joke. I mean, it's like a prank. But then, and then she told me, okay, Kanye's going to call you tonight or tomorrow night, whatever. So be ready for the call and stuff. And then, you know, and when that happened, I received the call, and then he's on the phone. And it sounds like him, but I'm still like, it's like, what? It's like this some, you know, impersonator or whatever. So we talked for a while, and then he told me that he wanted me to come to LA and stuff. And I was too busy at that point, and I couldn't go. But then, like 6 months later, maybe, they called me again. And then I had the time, and he flew me to LA, and I went there. I went to his studio. He has something, it looks like a little mall in Calabasas, where you know, there's lots of big rooms, and one room is the studio, and then another room, there's all this clothing, and there's all lots of kids working on shoes and this and that. And then you know, I just went there, and then at some point he enters the room, and it was Kanye. So at that point I really, it was really like, okay, this is actually for real.
Oh, wow.
And then, no, the shoe stuff is just that he showed me whatever he was working on, from songs to these new shoes. And he showed me around, you know, a new clothes, this clothing line and this and that. And it's, he's very soft spoken, and he's like looking for reactions, I suppose. Like he would show me stuff, and he was silent and just like, you know, expecting something, seeing how I react to you know, to this and that and whatnot. So it was lots of that, I suppose. And then, so he showed me lots of new tracks, lots of, singers and rappers he's also producing with his label. And then at some point he told me that he wanted to do this album with me. And by the way, the first connection for him was that he saw a movie that I did called The Girl with All the Gifts.
Oh, right.
And for somehow the music got his attention. So that's why he got to me. And yeah, so that's it. So I was working there for a little bit, and I found these voices are the main thing that came out that I thought was pretty cool, and it felt like something. It felt important for some reason. Like whenever I'm gonna use this stuff, it felt like it was going to do something. So it has to be for the right occasion, and for this White Lotus, it was perfect because they had those voices had the somehow the drive and the character that fit with what's happening in this show. So it was just like a perfect fit, and it went well. I'm happy that was a good instinct. Because it took I had those voices for 3 or 4 years.
It's absolute. I think it is. It's the perfect home for that, and that's certainly what seems to be a lot of people are responding to. There's this, again, as we were saying before, the feeling of something that's very familiar. You recognize it, but there's something slightly off about it. It's not necessarily a nightmarish feeling. In some ways, it's actually quite funny. I find the main theme to be quite humorous, and I think that's also intentional. You are kind of pretty obviously poking fun at the characters and their position within this show. And then there is, to me, another aspect which comes up in the work which relates to the human voice, and that's breath, and literally using breath as a rhythmic device or just as part of another way that you're playing, like you're playing these really big flutes or these bottles and stuff, and you hear the big intake of breath, and it creates this other tension, which is a feeling of suffocation. Like you feel a little bit like there's a tension that's built right into those actions. And again, I'm assuming that this is all coming out of an approach. You and Mike White are talking about the show. He's got this idea of a Hawaiian Hitchcock. Like it's supposed to be mystery. It's dark, but there's humor. And you just go and start experimenting as fast as you can. With the sort of key was that the Kanye voices, for lack of a better word, but the voices that you came up with the idea while you were with Kanye, was that one of the first things you reached for, or did that come later on?
Yeah, it was. I think the very first cue that I sent had those voices already. It wasn't in the form of the theme. It was a cue that is very tribal and much faster than the theme. But those voices were in there with that melody from the theme. So it was the very first thing that I sent. And then I started developing on that particular cue, and it became several versions of that kind of tribal sound.
Yeah, it evokes, again, as you said in other interviews, there's it feels like a zoo. You're looking at people almost like they're monkeys within this show. You know, they're how you would see go to the zoo and observe monkeys. And the other thing that I find really interesting is a use of sort of background source sound design, not sound design, but like environmental sounds. How do you think about those things? Do you feel that it's just it's a textural element? Do you find that there's some sort of like emotion that it's evoking for you, and that's why you're using it?
Sometimes birds have this cuckoo thing about them. There's something about birds in music that there's a craziness to it for some reason. You know, there's this diner scenes where. Sometimes you see people talking, but there's no you can't hear the dialogue. It's just a camera moving around, and people drinking and having fun and stuff. When you see the girls talking, they seem to be bitching about something, talking about somebody and stuff like that. And sometimes in those places, I would put like birds or monkeys and stuff. and honestly, I don't know how articulated. It's just that it just looks really good when that happens, and there's these monkeys and stuff, and I don't know. I don't know what the joke is exactly. I don't know how to explain what that's funny.
Right. Yeah.
It's like whatever they're saying, maybe it's not that important, or no, I don't know. I don't know. I really can't explain it. It just feels like the right thing. They feel like chimpanzees going. I'm saying chimpanzee. I don't like to. I'd rather not compare these people to animals because I love animals. So, and these people are not always very likable.
Right.
But I'm going to say chimpanzees because chimpanzees are very close to us, and they're just they can get really crazy and abusive and human in more than one way.
Again, it goes back to, you know, you obviously have really good instincts, and you have developed a practice of being able to listen to those instincts and obviously overcome any self-doubt or voices in your own head that tell you maybe that's too crazy of an idea. And the success of White Lotus and your work, that is really, I mean, this is one of those things where you're getting pretty much everyone in town calling you to want to talk to you about the score, and you got people coming out and making videos about how the music makes them feel. And I mean, it's just one of those really rare moments where a composer is thrust into the spotlight and everyone acknowledges the huge part that the music has played in the work. Has it changed your life considerably? And do you find yourself distracted, wrestling with things, having to sort of, you know, you do things differently in order to maintain some sort of, handle on your life and work?
It feels the best it's ever been, in a way that maybe it has made my life even easier, in the sense that what I'm supposed to do, as what my style is, how I'm supposed to help image, because the people, everybody that called me because of that, is because some were fans of the White Lotus, and some others were not necessarily fans of the show, but they understood what the music was doing for the show. So they call me because they want me to do the same for them, for whatever project they were doing. And it's not about the sounds, the aesthetic necessarily, but I think it's because of the energy. And that led me to understand a thing that for me was a bit of a struggle, in the sense that sometimes I would watch movies where the music felt too much. And sometimes when I had tensions in the past with some producers, it was because they were really pushy about, they wanted me to do something, and it felt too much, it felt exaggerated. And in my mind, I was seeing those movies that I don't like, where the music is just over the top, it's working too hard to make you feel, there's so much action that you are seeing right now. It's like the music is explaining to you how exciting what you're watching is.
Right.
And now I understand better what they want. And it's not necessarily that the music needs to go into this cheesiness and exaggeration and whatnot. On one hand, the other thing is that producers might not be able to explain in a way that, you know, a musician understands, or that I understand. So this somehow made it clear that I could still do what I do, but give them more of that when they need more, when they need the music to really come up front and you know, like push the movie out there somehow into the audience. I understand what that means and how to do it being myself, not doing something that I'm going to hate afterwards because it's just too much and blah blah. So you know, there's a bad taste thing where you know, if someone is asking you to do something so sentimental, so emotional, that it's just, it's like a super syrupy and it's just, it's soapy, you know, and stuff. But you can actually do that and still do something good. And it's even more fun, but it's hard to find your own way to do it and not be cheesy or, you know, or whatever. But so that changed something for me, I think, because it felt like I was doing a lot. The music, it was really a character in The White Lotus. And it's not the first time, I mean, that happens. I mean, Utopia was that too. The music was, I think, really was a character. It's just that I didn't know it. Those first projects that I did, I was just trying to do good music. That's pretty much it. I wasn't conscious of any of this stuff. I didn't realize that Utopia, you know, he was a character and this and that and blah, blah. So, yeah, it's just been a journey of understanding how I'm supposed to do things.
Mm. That's amazing. I think that's so, that's a very exciting place to be, to have that kind of success, to be recognized for what you do, and then to also feel like there's a huge, you know, something you've learned about your own craft and your path to mastery that is very impactful. So that's beautiful. What are you working on now? What's sort of fascinating you or keeping your attention that you can talk about?
I'm working on a horror movie, which is pretty... somehow old school in the way that it's like true horror. It's what you expect, with lots of jumps, and it's brutal, it's gore, and it's really over the top. So I'm a horror fan, and this is the first chance I get to do something which is like that. I mean, I've done some horror before, but in a way, it's not like the horror movies that I grew up watching, like 80s horror or 90s horror, where there's an interest to the gore, to all this stuff. Where lots of recent horror movies, it's like it's about everything but the gore. It's like maybe this is what we call the, you know, elevated horror or whatnot. And sometimes it feels like just a thriller. It's like a thriller or a drama with some hints here and there that it's okay, it's horror, but not really. I mean, so this one is like real, it's a horror movie to people to, you know, gather together and start yelling at the screen when something happened and laughing. it's a party, yeah. You know, it's a party. It's a different thing. So I really enjoy that. I really like that stuff.
That's great.
Yeah, so this is a movie I've been working for a while now. And it's going to come out, I'm not sure, but maybe this summer or something. It's called Something's Wrong with Rose. It's with Suzy Bacon, Kevin Bacon's daughter. And who's amazing. She's a really talented actress. I didn't know her at all. But she's a great surprise. I wasn't expecting this level of acting. It's a new director. His name is Parker Finn. He did a short last year called Laura Hasn't Slept. And it went really well in the festivals and stuff. So Paramount, they pick him right away to make his first feature. So he got lucky, I guess. He got to do his first movie with Paramount. Good stuff.
That's good. That must be fun to work with someone so fresh. The excitement and enthusiasm must just be through the roof.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm more often being the junior in this stuff, where everybody has done like 200 movies, and I'm the guy who has no idea what he's doing. So, but yeah, somehow now, in this particular project, I'm more experienced. So, yeah, it's cool. It's fun.
That's great. Well, Cristobal, this has been a true pleasure, especially myself being such a fan of your work, and to hear you delve more deeply into, you know, your process and your approach to things and your feelings about working to the screen. It's been really inspiring. So thank you very much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. If people want to follow you, I know you're sort of on Twitter, at Cristobal Music. Is there anywhere else that you're sort of hanging out online?
Not really. Sometimes I post videos on YouTube, not necessarily all the time, like the movies I'm working or something. So, I do mashups. YouTube is more like a playground. I just post.
Oh, that's fun.
I just post whatever. But I'm not very Facebooky, Instagrammy. that's it.
Beautiful. Well, more important things to do. Again, congrats on the success of White Lotus and everything else. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing and seeing what's next from you. Thanks again for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes and tagging us at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. The Screen Composers Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Editing, graphics, audio, and video post-production by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our Managing Director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as the SOCAN Foundation for financial support.